I teach in the Department of Philosophy and direct the program in Ethics and Public Life. The presidential campaigns have raised deep issues of vital human importance. When is inequality too great? And should government try to reduce inequality? What's the role of private economic initiatives, of private property, of freedom from taxation in liberty? What's the impact of economic inequality on politics? And what has been the impact of politics on the steep rise in economic inequality over the last three decades? Why is democracy important? And is democracy threatened today? Deep questions of vital human importance. Whoever you're planning to vote for, and if you're undecided, I think you'll agree that the campaigns have not handled these deep issues with the depth that they deserve. That's not what campaigns are for, I guess. When the Obama campaign emphasized the great job that Mitt Romney's tax accountants had done in legally reducing his tax burden, it probably didn't deeply illuminate the question of what the fundamental moral importance of economics inequality is. And certainly when the Romney campaign showed Barack Obama saying that a business person doesn't succeed in business on her own and omitted his explanation that he meant that she couldn't succeed if the government didn't build roads, that didn't deeply illuminate questions of freedom, equality, and the common good. Well, that's where we come in this Ethics and Public Life series. Six eminent figures will address deep issues raised by the presidential campaign with the depths that they deserve. First, two eminent political scientists will speak to us. Jacob Hacker today on the impact of American politics on the American dream. On September 24th, Larry Bartels from Political Science at Vanderbilt on the interaction of politics and economic inequality. Then two philosophers will come. On October 15th, David Schmitz will come from the Department of Philosophy at Arizona. David is somebody towards the libertarian end of the political spectrum. He will talk about democracy and corporate welfare. Then on October 29th, Harry Brickhouse will come from the Department of Philosophy at Wisconsin-Madison. He is at the egalitarian end of the spectrum and will talk about equality of opportunity and education. On November 12th, Doug McAdam from sociology at Stanford, a deep student of social movements, will come and talk to us about what he sees as long-term threats to the viability of American democracy. And finally, on November 26th, Hillary Hoyne from the Department of Economics at UC Davis will come to discuss economic insecurity and the safety net. Extremely diverse topics addressed from extremely diverse disciplines and from diverse perspectives. You might think no one person can shed light on topics of vital importance with this broad range, but some people can. Jacob Hacker from the Political Science Department at Yale has shed light on all of the topics that I have named. That makes him a perfect start to our series. Suzanne Mettler from the Government Department will introduce him.
It is truly a joy for me to introduce our speaker to you today. Jacob Hacker is a professor of political science at Yale University, where he is the director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies and the Stanley B. Resor Professor of Political Science. Professor Hacker's accomplishments are vast and impressive, frankly, too many for me to summarize here. But I'd like to mention some aspects of his career that I think might be particularly compelling to many of the undergraduates who are here in the audience today. When he was an undergraduate himself at Harvard in the early 1990s, Jacob Hacker spent two summers working as an intern in Washington, D.C., analyzing healthcare legislation on the Hill, including Bill Clinton's reform plan. He returned to Harvard and wrote a senior thesis on the rise and fall of Clinton's plan. That thesis became the basis for his first book, The Road to Nowhere. When it was published just a few years later, it won a major book award of the National Academy of Public Administration. Professor Hacker went on to earn the PhD, and since then he has written numerous books and scholarly articles about health and social policy, including retirement benefits and tax policy, and how these affect or fail to address, as the case may be, economic inequality and insecurity in the United States. His books include Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, which was with Paul Pearson, The Great Risk Shift, The New Economic Insecurity and the Decline of the American Dream, and The Divided Welfare State, The Battle over Public and Private Social Benefits in the United States. Hacker's influence has extended far beyond academia, however. He frequently publishes essays for broad audiences at popular outlets, and he has testified before Congress and advised leading politicians. In 2007, he authored a proposal for universal health care, Health Care for America. It became a template for several presidential candidates' plans, as well as briefs on how and why to encourage private health insurance to compete with a new public health plan for the non-elderly, the so-called public option. Recently, Professor Hacker with Nate Lowenthal of Yale Law School wrote an economic blueprint, Prosperity Economics, Building an Economy for All, that sets forth a plan to broadly spread economic growth and security for Americans. The proposal was supported by a coalition of labor, community, and civil rights groups as part of a new campaign called Prosperity for All. We in the profession of political science are proud to have Professor Hacker in our midst, and we consider him one of our brightest stars. Moreover, he is a model of a serious academic who also manages to devote time, talent, and energy to applying the lessons of his research to pressing policy debates today. It is with great pleasure that I welcome Professor Hacker to address us now on the question, is American politics undermining the American
dream? Thanks, Suzanne. Thank you. Okay, wow. That was quite an introduction. I think anything I say after that is going to be a bit of a letdown. So let me just start by saying I'm extreme, and also this thing is starting to move. Let me start by saying I'm very pleased to be here. When Dick came to me and asked me to lead off the series, I was both honored and excited, and I'm really pleased to see so many people here. Suzanne, thank you for that great introduction, and thank you, Dick, for yours. I'm going to try to keep the thanks short because I'd like to spend as much of our time possible having a conversation about some of these issues. So I want to keep my presentation to roughly 40 to 45 minutes. And whenever I'm in a time-constrained situation, I think back to an evaluation I received when I was a new assistant professor at Yale. And it began quite promisingly. It said, Professor Hacker, if I had just 15 minutes to live, I'd want to spend it in your class. Because that way it would seem like an hour. So I hope the next 40 minutes seems close to 40 minutes. I also do want to take a few more minutes just to thank my co-author, Paul Pearson. The two of us have worked on a previous book, Off Center, which was about how Republicans were moving to the right and Democrats were moving. Republicans were moving dramatically to the right, and Democrats were moving modestly to the left. I think that one's been a bit vindicated by subsequent events. The two of us have published this a couple years ago before the Occupy Wall Street protests began. It's been a really, I don't know if enjoyable is the right thing to say, but a really interesting experience to watch American politics come to focus much more on this set of issues since we wrote the book. Now, one way in which they focus on these issues is an endless series of polls discussing and examining how Americans feel about rising inequality. And perhaps the most recent I was able to find is from the Pew Research Centers. This is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research institute. And They asked, up above you see the changes in median net worth. Pretty strikingly, we're back to levels of net worth, including housing for the typical household that are roughly where they were in the early 1980s. I'll say a little more about that in a moment. But below that, they also have a response from survey people they surveyed who self-identified themselves as middle class, asking them whether or not it was easier or harder to get ahead than it was a decade ago. And as you can see, there was an overwhelming sense, not surprisingly in the wake of the Great Recession, that things had gotten much harder. And in fact, if you did similar surveys, and there were surveys before 2007, before the recession, there was a widespread sense of gloom then as well. The summary of it is not much better put than the Pew Research Center's own title for this report: "The Lost Decade of the Middle Class, Fewer, Poorer, Gloomier." So I don't want to spend today providing you with too much gloom, especially with the sun outside. So what I'd like to do is talk a bit about what's happened to the middle class and how that links up to the great rise in inequality, and in particular what I'll call winner-take-all inequality, the concentration of income and wealth at the very top of the income distribution over the last generation. But then I want to turn, after talking about this and its main causes, I want to turn to a question of what can be done. What are the prospects for a serious effort to tackle reverse some of the trends of the last generation? Are we consigned to another lost decade for the American middle class? Now, it's, as I said, not so surprising that there was a sense of gloom after the Great Recession. And yet, that gloom is tied up with more than just the economic strains of that period. Over the last three decades, the share of pre-tax national income that accrued to the richest 1% of Americans roughly doubled. The share that went to the richest 1/10 of 1%, so the top 1 in 1,000 households, more than quadrupled. Who are these fortunate few at the very top? Well, about 6 in 10 of those in the top 1/10 of 1% are executives, financial and corporate executives. And so really, in large part, what I'm going to be talking about at this particular level of inequality is the pulling away of financial and corporate elites over the last generation. Now, this was pretty clear even before the downturn in soaring CEO salaries, in the bonuses that were being taken home on Wall Street, in the discussion of tax cuts and investment incentives that were dominating American politics. But the basic message that was coming out of Washington, at least a few years ago, is that there was really nothing to be done, and perhaps nothing to worry about as well. Hank Paulson, for example, the Treasury Secretary, who was also a former Goldman Sachs executive, put it this way in 2006. "Economic inequality," said, "is simply an economic reality, and it is neither fair nor useful to blame any political party." Now, you can sort of forgive Paulson for his dismissive view, since it's pretty clear which party he thought was being unfairly and uselessly blamed, but to his defense, in his defense, Paulson was really summing up the conventional view among not just popular commentators, but also professional experts. There was a widespread sense that economic inequality was a result of broad economic forces, namely increased economic globalization and technological change, that had led to a growing divide between those with skills, particularly the college educated, and those who had less capacity to adapt to this new economic realities. This view was echoed at the top by a sense of triumph. Sandy Weill, the former head of Citigroup, put it this way in a New York Times profile, appropriately entitled "The New Gilded Age," back in the mid-2000s. "People can look at the last 25 years," Sandy Weill said, "and say this was an incredibly unique period of time. We didn't rely on somebody else to build what we built." And in this view, a view widely shared even today, I think, but less widely discussed, the titans of finance were superstars who were surfing the new waves of the global economy. So it's worth knowing that before Citigroup went down in flames and Weil lost his job and his office, in his office was a trophy on the wall. It was the banking equivalent of a stuffed lion's head, a hunk of wood, at least 4 feet wide, I'm told, etched with his portrait and the words Shatterer of Glass-Steagall written below his name. Now, for those who don't know, and I assume very few don't know by now, Glass-Steagall was the Depression-era New Deal regulation that drew a line between old-style traditional banking and investment. And it is the line, of course, that banks increasingly were crossing even before Glass-Steagall was repealed and the repeal was signed into law by President Clinton. And it's notable, then, that Sandy Weil didn't wait for somebody else to build what he built. No, he went out and he pushed for the repeal of Glass-Steagall. When the bill was being signed, the other banker involved in the deal was asked, well, because they signed the deal for Citi to create the Citigroup before Glass-Steagall had been repealed, the other banker was asked, well, what about Glass-Steagall? And the banker said, oh, we'll just have Sandy talk to his friend, the president, about that. So this is not, I don't want to focus here on, in retrospect, we can see now, the sort of cluelessness that was inherent in this view that finance was removed in some sense from the normal laws of the rest of our economy, that these bankers were not, that these financiers were not creating systemic risk, that deregulation was an unalloyed good. Rather, I want to unravel, if you will, a puzzle about these developments. It's a puzzle that's wrapped inside a riddle and then inside a mystery. The puzzle, as I'll discuss, is why American society has grown more unequal, but not just more unequal in general, but more unequal in a specific way, the way that I was talking about before, the pulling away of the top, especially the top 1% and the top 1/10 of 1% and higher. The riddle is how, as we show in Winner Take All Politics, this was driven by what our government did and didn't do, by public policies that were pursued and deliberately blocked. And finally, the mystery that motivated the book in the first place and that ties this together is why. Why did this happen in the world's oldest continuous democracy, a nation in which we all believe the vast middle class is supposed to hold tremendous sway? And my answer to that question will in turn open up the final question, which is, where does this leave us? What are the possibilities for reform given what I've said up till now? Now, we hear a lot about the haves versus the have-nots. So if I can leave you with one message in this talk, it's that we really should be talking about the have-it-alls versus the rest. And one way to think about this is to look at statistics. In fact, there's one figure that sums up the book, and I'm going to warn you that I'm going to show a few figures over the course of this talk. My defense, such as it is that I once heard an eminent commentator say that it was the mark of an educated man to be deeply moved by statistics. But my guess is you may not share my passion, so I'll hopefully be able to walk you through them quickly. Someone does share my passion, however. These are Occupy Wall Street protesters holding up a sign of Congressional Budget Office data. So I figured you can't really get a much more wonky protest than that, and I'm gonna take a lead from that and show you the same data, a little bit different form. Now, in this figure, which is taken from the book, and basically shows incomes for each of the quintiles of the distribution, so the poorest fifth up through the top 20%. You can see I've broken the top 20% into the top 1%, and then the 80th to 99th percentile. For two periods, 1979, for 2 years, 1979 and 2007, this is after tax income that includes all government benefits. It also takes into account the value of in-kind compensation like health insurance and retirement pensions, as well as in-kind cash, in-kind transfers from the government of the same form. In other words, it's trying to capture all of the things that we think of as a family's household income. So let's go back in time to 1979. I know many of you in the room were not yet born. I was 8, and at that time you can see that the United States already featured some pretty stark divides. We're not living in some kind of egalitarian fantasy land in the mid-20th century, but we were living in a society, for those of you who have looked at this period, in which income differences were not growing. That is, from roughly the 1945, the end of World War II, until the mid-1970s, all income groups experienced about the same growth in income. In fact, it was slightly higher toward the lower ends of the incomes distribution, and so inequality declined slightly over this period. But the real story is after the mid-1970s, and conveniently, the Congressional Budget Office data starts in 1979. So we're in 1979. We're just on the verge of the disco revolution. We're all dancing in bell bottoms. And you can see that the middle fifth of Americans have an average household income in real dollars adjusted for inflation of somewhere in the range of $45,000. Let's fast forward, if you will, to 2007. So this really is the story of the last generation. Most of the gains of economic growth have gone to the very top. So that middle fifth saw its income rise from around $45,000 to $55,000, which is a non-trivial increase of 25%. But for the top 1%, you can see that the gains were much larger, 281% over this period. In after-tax, government benefit income adjusted for inflation. Now, there are a few things that I just want to point out here, since for many of you have probably recognized that the top 1% was a major beneficiary of post-1970s household income growth. In fact, if you took all the household gains that occurred since 1979, roughly 40% of those gains, after taxes, after benefits, accrued to the richest 1%. And that's why their share of income rose so dramatically. So most people, I think, are aware of this, and they've seen the signs. But I think one thing that I want to point out is that this occurred over a period in which there was broad growth in the economy. So that, I guess, is obvious since somebody received that growth. But who received that growth was clearly not the middle class to any substantial degree. In fact, most of the gains that occurred for the middle fifths of Americans occurred because of increased work hours rather than because of higher incomes. And you can see this quite here, clearly here. The median hourly compensation, that's wages plus benefits, basically stayed stable, rose about 10% from 1973 to 2009, even though productivity rose about 80% over that period. And you can see that male compensation essentially didn't rise at all. And that's the median. If you look at workers with an entry-level male worker without a college degree, the trend has been, of course, negative. Even an entry-level male worker with a college degree is earning barely more than such a worker was a generation ago, and they're less likely to have health insurance. Now, this is, of course, income. There are other things, and this is where the slogan, the 99%, of course, comes from. This is income, of course, but other trends we'll talk about in a moment were also leading to greater strains for the middle class. So the first thing I want to do, though, before moving on to them, is to make clear that in some ways the focus on the top 1% is misleading. Chris Hayes has a new book out in which he talks about fractal inequality, by which he means that at any level of inequality, you find greater inequality. So if you take the top 1%, the inequality within the top 1% is also following this winner-take-all pattern. Now, he points this out to say, and I think this is true, that even people who are doing pretty well can always find someone else who's doing even better than they are. But what I would take from it and just want to emphasize is that when we talk about the top 1%, we're really missing where most of the action was. So the CBO did exactly the same thing from 1979 to 2005 and broke out the top 1%. So this group here is the merely affluent, the bottom half of the top 1%. And this group, the technical definition is, I believe, the filthy rich, right? The top 1/100th of 1%. Okay, so let's do our little time travel again. Again, the top 1/100th of 1% was doing quite well back in 1979. And once again, we see that within the top 1%, the gains were quite concentrated at the top as well. So
This is important for a couple reasons I'll get to in a moment. First of all, it means, as I said, we need to focus on who these folks are. Who is in these top two slices? As I said, it's mostly corporate and financial executives. Any story that is plausibly explaining what happened for them has to take into account who has to say something about what happened to corporate salaries and financial markets. The second reason this is useful in focusing is that we start to focus more on what government does that affects these folks. And I'll say more about that in a moment. Now, before I go on, you might wonder if the downturn has fundamentally reversed this since 2007 was the last year in my data. And the answer is that initially, at least, it looks as if income concentration declined. The stock market drop hit capital owners much more sharply than it hit middle-class families, although middle-class families were hit harder in terms of the housing market drop. And since those at the top, as I'll say in a moment, get lots of their income through capital gains, much of it is labor income, that is, it's earnings, it's paid in the form of capital gains, they were hit much harder initially. However, in 2009 and 10, we started to see the same patterns reemerging. Emmanuel Saez, the Berkeley economist who's perhaps done more than anyone to chart the rising fortunes of the top, calculated that in 2010, about 93% of pre-tax income gains went to the top 1%. So you may wonder why lots of people don't feel the economy is improving, even as we see profits going up and the stock market going like gangbusters. And the answer is pretty simple. Much of those gains are going to a very small slice of Americans. Okay. One last thing I just want to mention, because I think in some ways it's more profound and more important over the long term, and that is that this was accompanied by at least two shifts in our society that aren't captured well by income. One was a stagnation of social mobility. So you might think, well, it's true that those at the top are doing better, but maybe the chances of getting into the top have gone up. And the answer, according to now a huge number of studies, is that social mobility didn't increase over this period. It may actually have declined. The other thing we've learned in studies of male intergenerational earnings mobility, which is a very long-winded way of saying how well sons do relative to their fathers, and you may wonder why we look at sons rather than daughters, and the answer is that much of this research, right, is looking back a generation. Going forward, I think the daughter-mother comparisons or daughter-father comparisons will be more instructive, but most of this work is focused on men. And what they found is the United States has essentially the lowest intergenerational mobility of any rich democracy. We're basically tied with a couple other countries. We're much lower than the Scandinavian democracies, some countries of continental Europe. And so again, in that dimension of mobility, it doesn't look as if there's been a change that's compensated. To the contrary, it looks as if perhaps social mobility has declined, even as inequality has grown. The second thing I want to mention is wealth. Because, of course, income is a flow, but wealth is a stock. And wealth is the way in which people, is the kind of safety net that people have and the opportunity springboard they have. It's what allows them to create those better opportunities for their children or to protect themselves against economic loss. And of course, it also allows themselves to protect themselves against economic loss or gain economic opportunities that come from politics. If you ask, well, who would be the most politically influential in a political system where money matters, it's obviously the wealthy. Not necessarily those who are rich in any given year, but those who have the most wealth to throw around. And we'll talk more about those people in a moment. So for a while, the sense was that as inequality grew, income inequality grew, wealth inequality wasn't following suit. But it looks as if that was mostly a lag, that more and more of the income gains have turned up in wealth gains. And here I just show the median wealth relative to the wealth of the top 1%. And you can see it's not a linear overtime relationship, but the general trend has been upward. And in 2009, mostly because of the huge declines in wealth for the typical family that we just saw, the wealth ratio skyrocketed. It may be a better way of understanding this is that the median wealth of white households in 2009 was, as we saw before, less than $100,000. Does anybody want to hazard a guess what the median wealth of a black household was, including housing, in that same year? I bet there's someone who knows. Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it's even in the 2009 data, it's about 2,500. But we're talking about, for a typical African-American household, their median wealth is pretty much zero, including housing. The other way to look at this is just the concentration of wealth, which is much greater than the concentration of income. So the top 10% of wealth holders hold about 3/4 of wealth in the United States. That's including housing, financial wealth. The top 1%, around 35% of wealth. So more than the share of income going to that group. Now, this is important, as Bill Clinton was saying in his speech. He kept saying, this is important. So this is important because this transformation, I think, calls on us to formulate explanations that have two distinctive qualities. The first is we have to explain why it is not that the rewards of growth have gone not just to the, say, college-educated, say the top 20%, but disproportionately to the top slices of that. We also have to ask, why did this occur in the United States? Now, I haven't told you yet that this is distinctively an American phenomenon, so I want to point out that it is not a uniquely American trend, but it is something that's quite distinctive to the so-called Anglo nations, United States, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK. And I'll show you that here using the top incomes database, which Manuel Saez and co-authors put together. It's a great resource for those who are interested in these issues. So first of all, we're going back to the early 1970s, and we can see remarkable similarity across countries in the share of income, excluding capital gains. This is quite important because these numbers are lower than ones you may have seen elsewhere because they exclude capital gains. It's also important, and just an aside, that capital gains are a bigger part of the story in the United States than they are in other rich countries. I think that has a lot to do with changes in American tax policy and corporate compensation practices that are related to them. But it's worth noting that whenever you see cross-national statistics, it's very hard to do them with capital gains to compare across countries. But if you don't include capital gains, you tend to understate how high American inequality is relative to other countries. So go back to the early 1970s. And now you see in the last year for which we have available data, and these vary a bit as you can see here, you can see the United States has seen not only has reached the highest level, but the biggest increase in the share of income going to the top. But it's not alone in seeing a big increase. On the other hand, these countries, Scandinavia, which started at a very low base, has seen a modest rise. And the continental European countries have basically seen no rise at all. So it's not only the United States. And if you're interested, and we can do this in question and answer session, you might ask, well, is there any correlation between this and growth in these countries? And the short answer is no. These countries grew diverse ways, but in ways that are not related to the rise in inequality in any obvious sense. And the United States had sort of middling growth over this period. So the United States did not experience a kind of economic miracle that allowed there to be such large gains at the top. While the middle class continued to get ahead. And I guess we know that since we saw the middle class experience relatively modest gains, even as the top pulled away. Okay, so what does this tell us? It tells us first that whatever explanation we have has to have a significant focus on the United States and perhaps the policies that were pursued by similar countries, Anglo countries. And as I said before, to go back to the earlier point, it has to explain what happened at the very top. So what I'm going to do in this part of the talk is offer basically an explanation that focuses on American public policy and changes in it, and then I want to talk about the political sources of those changes. And in a lot of ways, what I'll be doing will complement what Larry will be doing in his lecture 2 weeks from now. But you'll see when Larry comes that we have some differing views about what the fundamental drivers of this political changes are. So first of all, if we're talking about policy, the first place that we usually go is to think about redistribution, right? That's all that can be talked about on one side of the political spectrum right now, right? Government is redistributing. It wants to take someone's money and give it to someone else. That's important, but the United States is actually not much of a redistributor. In fact, over the last generation, according to the CBO, the degree to which the government reduces inequality through taxes and transfers is actually declined. Now, this is a very arcane number. It's based on the percentage reduction in a measure of inequality called the Gini index. You do not have to know anything more than that. Over the period in which inequality rose, government redistributed less. So this is to say that pre-tax incomes, yes, they grew more unequal, but government actually added to that inequality through federal policy, at least. But this is not going to explain what we were just talking about, right? Because a lot of the inequality occurs before government taxes and transfers. Also, this is a broad measure of inequality. So I want to focus on two things. First of all, if we're asking what happened at the top, let's talk a little bit about the policies that most affect the top. And in particular, here's something we've been talking about a little bit lately, taxes. Now, you've probably heard that taxes have dropped on the top 1%, and they have, pretty dramatically if you think about it. So this was the effective average tax rate paid by the top 1%. That's all federal taxes as an average of income. You make $200,000, you were paying a little bit less than $100,000 in federal taxes. Pretty substantial, and by this period, it's down to something like 60,000, right? About 30% of your income. But this is really actually only the tip of the iceberg. Let's take these higher groups that we were talking about before. Here's their top 0.1%. 6 and 10 are financial and corporate executives. Their average income, just for reference, in 2007 was around $7 million a year. Now let's take the top 1%. The top 100th of 1%. Their average income was gazillions. I don't actually know what their average income was. It was really high. And their income tax, their taxes have gone way, way down. Now, this, you can see, predates the Bush tax cuts. It was a bipartisan affair. Actually, we write a lot about how Carter cut the capital gains tax rate in 1978. But even here, you can see before 1978. Some of this is effective tax rates is due to the behavior of those at the top using the tax code. But a lot of it was about explicit policy changes. And I think a lot of people want to stop there and say, okay, so you calculate for me how much difference that makes in inequality, and I'll say that's the role government played. And then we can have a debate over whether this is a good or bad thing in terms of economic policy. But I want to try to convince you that that's a very narrow view, that essentially it assumes that all of the income that people earn in the market is somehow pre-governmental. There's no influence of government on the way markets work. And that, if you think about it for a moment, that's just ridiculous, right? If government encourages labor unions, that's going to change the way the market works. If government regulates finance in one way or another, it's going to change the way markets work and the way they distribute their rewards. So the second thing I want to talk about, besides the targeted tax cuts for the very top, which are dramatic, I want to talk a little bit about the targeted market-making policy changes that were pursued over this period. And the argument is really simple, right? That government not only played a role through redistribution, through taxes and transfers, but also through how it changed the rules of the game of the market over this period. Now, the most obvious way in which this happened now, and when we think back to Sandy Weill, is in financial market deregulation. And this one is actually an area where economists have, somewhat belatedly, devoted a huge amount of energy. So I'm going to show you a figure from a paper by two economists. I don't know if this says something about the excitement of economic arguments, but this was widely considered to be the most exciting economic research paper published in 2008. And what it showed is that the relative wage, that's this little red thing here, of finance professionals relative to similarly educated workers in other parts of the economy had gone way down in the wake of the New Deal and the financial reforms of that period, and then way back up in the late 1980s in tandem with deregulation. In fact, this little green line is just an index of financial regulation. Big increases in regulation in the 1930s, followed by some consolidation after World War II, stability in the system, and then deregulation at the same time as the relative wage is rising. So by the end of this period, and I can tell you by experience, my undergraduates know this, by the end of the period, workers in finance were earning almost twice what similarly educated and skilled, according to these measures, workers were earning elsewhere. Now, this may look familiar to you, this U-shaped curve. Maybe you've read the paper, or maybe you've seen the share of income going to the top figures that you often see now increasingly in the New York Times and other places, right? This is the share of income held by the top 10%. And you can see here that that share declined during the New Deal in the 1940s, World War II, stayed relatively stable until the late 1970s, and then starts to rise. David Moss of Harvard has also added to this some really interesting additional data that I think speaks very much to the influence of regulation on the markets. And it tells us two things. Now, we know that those in finance were earning a lot more and making up more and more of the top echelon of the economy over this period. But what I think this also shows us is that financial stability was very much linked up with financial regulation. So these blue are total number of bank failures. This sort of red one is the total deposits of those failed institutions. And you can see, just so you know, I mean, the pre-1930s economy was marked by wave after wave of destabilizing bank panics, culminating in the 1929 crash, right, where you had enormous number of bank failures and a huge number of assets. Now, if you go to the period after deregulation in the 1980s, well, maybe I should note, this period looks relatively free of financial panics. And then you go to the period after 1980 and you see, again, a marked rise in bank failures. This is the S&L crisis, of course, a nice period in the 1990s, followed by, of course, the mother of all financial crises. And so we at least have some circumstantial evidence that the policies that were pursued of deregulation not only increased rewards at the top in finance, but also was associated with greater systemic financial risk. And prior to the financial crisis, we might have said this wasn't of great concern to the rest of Americans. At this point, I think it's pretty hard to make that case. So we have other areas we talk about in the book, the decline of unions, the rise of corporate pay, that have a similar quality, where market making was more crucial than explicit public policy redistribution. But I want to talk about one final way in which government played a role, one that I think we're even less likely to see. And I call this drift. Drift occurs when government fails to update policy in the face of transformations in the market. And it fails to do so in the face of fierce efforts to block updating. So it's important to say here that drift is not apolitical. When government fails to act because powerful private interests don't want it to act, that is very much a policy fight. And the best example here, in some ways, is deregulation. Because it wasn't just that we saw a change in the financial rules, but we also saw a kind of pushing away of regulators over this period. So even when they had the opportunity to act, they were prevented by powerful private actors. There's an example from the late 1990s when the SEC chair Arthur Levitt wanted to pursue some tighter regulation of accounting standards, and he went to the chair of the Banking Committee at the time, Phil Graham, Republican of Texas. Remember him? And here's what Graham said to Levitt. I won't try to do his Texas accent. "Unless the waters are crimson with the blood of investors, I don't want you engaging in any regulatory flights of fancy." Just think about that for a moment, now that the waters are crimson red with the blood of investors. Graham was basically saying, and as Robert Rubin later would say in trying to hold off a regulation of derivatives, he was basically saying, if you go forward and try to use the powers you have, we will destroy you. And Wall Street had enormous sums and enormous power to do so over this period. And they were aided by the fact that even though we were seeing a shift in our economy that was creating pressures for inequality, our government was hamstrung by shifts in its own procedures. The greatest example here is, of course, the filibuster. The filibuster is now kind of remembered through the gauzy eyes of the 1930s movie with Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But as you all know, the modern filibuster bears little resemblance to that stunning display, which I will not recreate by passing out here, nor does it resemble the sort of Strom Thurmond 24-hour, 48-hour filibusters of the civil rights battles. Instead, filibusters are pocket filibusters. They're silent, and there are many going on at once. The changes in rules and the willingness of the minority to use the filibuster transformed this institution in the course of just a few decades. And it so happens that that transformation coincides with this period of rising inequality. In the 40 years before 1970, 40 years, there were 40 filibusters, fewer actually than that. In the 40 years after, more than 800 filibusters. And just in the last few years, there have been about a quarter of those filibusters have occurred. There were more than 200 filibusters in the lead up to the 2010 election. And this in part reflects growing polarization, but it also reflects a fundamental change in how our government works. And so fundamental that when James Madison wrote in Federalist 58 about whether we should have supermajority requirements for other things than, say, overcoming a veto or passing a constitutional amendment, he said, "We should not do that because the fundamental principle of free government would be reversed." So look at these numbers. Right? I mean, we are in a new world in which everything but the budget, and that's a notable exception, is basically subject to a 60-vote margin in the Senate. That makes it much harder in a dynamic market economy for government to respond in a constructive way. Moreover, it's occurring against a backdrop of not just growing inequality, but growing polarization. That means that the parties have a harder time reaching agreement in a system that makes it easier for the minority to block action. I lived for a year in Berkeley, California, enjoying that Edenic place and the fresh vegetables and fruits, but also watching the dysfunctional California legislature operate. And whenever I think about where we're going after the debt ceiling crisis, watching the filibuster become more of a spectacle, I think of California, right? Where even the business community now is alarmed that Republicans are able to use supermajority rules against raising taxes to block any constructive action, where there's a sense that the promise of the state built on a strong public education system, built on an investment in research and development, is being lost because the government itself is hamstrung by procedures and polarization. So that's, I promise I'll get to the happy stuff in a moment. So that's what happened. Why? Why did government do it? I mean, that's the big puzzle, right, from a political science perspective. And I think the natural impulse is to start to look very quickly into the mind of the American voter. Is it, as Thomas Frank argued, that Americans are being blinded from their true economic interests by social issues? Or could it be, as many Republicans like to argue, that Americans really want tax cuts for the rich and growing inequality? Or could it be, as Democrats contend on the other side, that voters are confused and being hoodwinked by powerful private interests? So we always want to look at the voter. But I think it's useful to step back and ask, well, what drives politics on many of these issues? When it comes to changes in deregulation or union laws, it's not the voter that decides often, it's organized pressure.
Lobbying.
The ability to push for long periods of time for policy change. Let me give you an example. We've only had one survey about the hedge fund loophole, it's sometimes called. This is the carried interest provision that Mitt Romney has benefited enormously from. It says that if you are a private equity manager or a hedge fund manager and you're earning income from your management of other people's assets, usually following a specific rule called the 2-in-20 rule, then you can treat that income, even though it's not from your own private investments, as capital gains, right? So you get to pay 15% capital gains rate rather than the ordinary income tax rate on your income. It's actually, given how few people get affected by it, it actually costs the federal government quite a lot of money because those people make billions of dollars in some cases. In 2006, the Democrats came into office vowing that they would end the carried interest provision. And by the way, it's very hard to find anyone besides private equity managers who defends it. It survived. 2008, Democrats, including President Obama, come in vowing they will end the carried interest provision. 2010, it survives. 2010, the Republicans come in vowing they will preserve. Oh, sorry. But no. But there was, you know, a huge amount of fight over where we could get a little bit of money from the top, right? When and the carried interest provision would seem like a pretty straightforward way to raise, you know, some billions of dollars. It still survives, right? It's very hard to believe that this is a reflection of where voters are on this issue. We can see it, too, with regard to tax cuts. Now, it's true that Americans have an ambivalent feeling about taxes, they have the sort of view of tax cuts that you might have of junk food, right? I really shouldn't, but it might be really great to just have a little bit more. On the other hand, when you ask people, there is overwhelming support for letting the tax cuts for the very top expire. However, that view has not been able to gain any traction, even though there's an enormous amount of leverage that comes from the fact that these tax cuts are up for renewal. We'll see where that goes. Another example, the one that I think resonates the most right now. There was a prominent public figure, now prominent, once hidden, who said, "Our main interest is not participating in campaigns. Our main interest is in policy." That was David Koch. The billionaires, Charles and David Koch, enormously richer than they were a generation ago, have devoted an enormous amount of their resources to trying to reshape the landscape of American politics. We've heard a lot about it. Perhaps the number that sort of sticks with me the most is that Charles and David Koch and their network will spend more in this election than John McCain did in the 2008 presidential election alone. The resources that are being deployed in this case for elections, but often they're being deployed to try to reshape policy. Corporations put most of their money, I'm going to skip through this, corporations put most of their money into lobbying, not into campaigns. And the amount spent on lobbying has risen enormously. So too have the number of lobbyists, though they've declined in recent years. We went from having essentially a handful of lobbyists working Washington a generation ago to around 15,000 lobbyists in 2007. Now, part of this is that the money that gets power and then uses it to protect money is facing a much more open environment than it used to, because some of the traditional groups that were on the other side of the political spectrum or of the battles they fought have lost ground. Labor unions are the most obvious example. Civic organizations, as Sita Scotchpole has written, used to be much more broader based and much more likely to have cross-class memberships. And what's happened, in other words, is that the ecosystem of Washington has sort of fundamentally changed. It's changed in the way that an ecosystem might change in the jungle, right? The Washington jungle, let's call it, has changed so that both parties have to adapt. That's why it's so stale to say, oh, it's all the Republicans' fault or it's all the Democrats' fault, because both parties have had to operate in this new environment. Now, for Republicans, this has been a much happier outcome, right? For them, the new political environment that where money counts more, where there's more organization and affluence, supporting conservative causes has been empowering, right? And it helps explain why we've seen not just polarization, but quite unequal polarization, as I'll show in a moment, where the right has gotten much more conservative and the left only modestly more liberal. But for Democrats, the effects have been much more mixed, right? For Democrats, it's, on the one hand, potentially a source of funds that allows Democrats to emerge from essentially the clobbering they were getting for about two decades from Republicans in the money chase to wage serious campaigns. Rahm Emanuel has this great quote we have in the book where he famously explained his philosophy for winning campaigns. He said, you can divide a campaign into three parts. He said, the first part is money, money, money. The second part is money, money, press. And the third part is money, press, votes. Now, if you're keeping track at home, that's votes one, right, and money six, or seven. So Emanuel was able to tap into the Wall Street Network, and many other Democrats were as well, to be able to wage much more serious campaigns. But at the same time, right, they were being pulled away from some of their traditional constituencies, right, as labor was losing ground And so for Democrats, I think there's been much more cross pressure for the party. And I think that helps explain the kind of oscillation, right? I mean, at this convention, you have these very populist themes, mostly before primetime, but they were there. And then you have super PAC retreats, right, for high-flying donors. You have lots of Democrats in The New Yorker complaining that Barack Obama just doesn't know how to glad-handle the wealthy at the same time, right, as you have a call for major tax cuts on the top. It's cross-pressure versus empowerment. And you see it in the numbers. I said polarization has been highly unequal. I think most people don't recognize just how much so that it's been. Now, I'm going to be using these scores that come from looking at congressional votes. And this is not really how you're supposed to use them. So what I will just say is that this is a rough measure of how much more liberal or conservative members of Congress have become. I basically got the average House Democrat, the average Senate Democrat, the average Senate Republican, and then the average House Republican. And this is just basically, on these scores, you know, what percentage increase has there been? Now, for Democrats, they've gotten more liberal, and for Republicans, they've gotten more conservative. The problem is these measures are very hard to measure over long spans of time. There's no natural base, right? So using a percentage change is not entirely kosher within the discipline. But trust me, if I graphed them or if I showed you the raw numbers, it would look the same as this. OK, so first you have House Democrats. They've gotten only modestly more liberal, and that makes sense. They gained the House, for example, by recapturing a lot of blue dog districts. And Senate Democrats have gotten a little bit more liberal. But let's look at House and Senate Republicans. So Senate Republicans, much, much more conservative than have Senate Democrats. But here's the real story, right? The House Republican caucus is a very, very conservative caucus. I don't know how else to show this than perhaps to mention one of their standard bearers, Paul Ryan. Why? Because here is Ryan's tax cut proposal. Now, you've been hearing a lot more about this. When I was first showing these slides, people were quite surprised. But now the sort of surprise has worn off. But I want to note, for the record, that I recognize that Paul Ryan says he will close loopholes necessary to fund this $5 trillion in tax cuts. Nonetheless, it's a little revealing that he has not specified a single loophole. He said he would not change the favorable tax treatment of capital gains, and that almost every independent expert who's looked at this doesn't think you could raise the funds necessary to create this $1.18 million tax cut for each person in household in the top 0.1%. Or that you could do that without raising taxes on the middle class. This is on top of the Bush tax cuts, right? So this is a really significant additional tax cut targeted overwhelmingly on the wealthy, much more skewed toward the top than were the Bush tax cuts of 2001. And I think that's a pretty good illustration, right, of how much more conservative the Republican House caucus has become, right? Because remember, the policy has moved dramatically in their direction, right? They got the Bush tax cuts, and they're still there. And they're saying, on top of that, I would like to have more tax cuts for the very, very wealthy. There is one other way to look at this, which is to ask, what is the implied effect of candidate Romney's proposals on public spending? And it's really important to understand that the government does essentially three things that really have huge public spending impact, right? One is defense. This is not an order, by the way. A second is Social Security. And a third is healthcare, Medicare and Medicaid. So if you think about it, right, any proposal that is going to come up with significant additional money for tax cuts that is going to reduce the deficit over time and that isn't going to increase the size of the federal government is going to involve big cuts in one or more of those three, Medicare and Medicaid, healthcare, Social Security, or defense. Now, the Republicans have actually said defense is off the table. In fact, want to increase spending on it. So it's going to come out of those two areas. So the Romney proposal, according to Congressional Budget Office estimates that are analyzed here by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, would essentially slash the federal government down to, I think it's hard to summarize these numbers, right? By 40% in 22, right? So So if you have a balanced budget amendment, which Romney supports, you would essentially cut the size of everything else in the federal government by 40% to get the tax cuts and the defense spending increases. If you do, then you'd have to reduce the federal government by 60%. That's not a credible scenario, but it suggests a sense of priorities. What we know from the public opinion data is that Americans think that there are three ways we could reduce the deficit that they support, and that's not to say that this represents a fully fleshed out public agenda for reform. One, they would like to increase taxes on somebody else, namely the top. Two, they think that we should cut defense spending. And three, they hope that we can come up with a magical pot at the end of the rainbow that we can tap into to cover the rest. But the two number one consistent ways in which to reduce the deficit are categorically at odds with the agenda here. Why is this happening? Could it be that Republicans are more responsive to deep-pocketed backers and activists? That's, I think, the argument I want to make, that organization matters. The other thing I want to mention before I turn to what's to be done is that a really important part of this story is that Americans have ceased to have much faith that the federal government can deal with the strains in their lives. So in tandem with these organizational and economic shifts, I think there's been a fundamental decline in public trust in civic institutions and a sense of connectedness to the political system. Suzanne has written write quite well about this and how it's linked up with changes in policy, but I just want to note it. If I was going to put my money on one change that matters the most for the public, it's not increasing conservatism, it's increasing cynicism. It's an increasing sense that that government cannot challenge, cannot respond to, cannot effectively represent the middle class in the face of these stark changes in our society. Now, this may seem like a depressing story, and in some ways it is, but in some ways it's not, because the story we've been hearing so often is this is a result of kind of inevitable economic changes. What I've shown you is that it's tied up, much more tied up, with changes in our politics. It's tied up with the shifts in our tax code over the last generation. It's tied up with financial deregulation and the decline of unions. It's tied up with the increasing difficulty our government has responding to changes in our economy due to the filibuster. And it's tied up with the transformation of the Washington ecosystem that's occurred as money has become more important in American politics, as organized business interests have become more powerful. And in that sense, right, our problem is far more political than economic. And that, in some ways, is the message I want to leave you with and where I want to focus my last remarks. You know, Walter Lippmann famously said that democracy has to lift itself up by its own bootstraps. That's the catch-22 of political reform. If you believe, as I do, deeply in our political system and its capacity for renewal, then you have to work through a broken political system to restore it. And to do that, as I've suggested, we're going to have more than a short-term focus on elections. I actually think this is an area where there's actually grounds for some degree of, if not consensus, at least broad agreement about some of the necessary changes. You know, if the focus is on tax rates and redistribution, I think many Americans, battered by the trends of the last decade, increasingly subject to the call of activist claims, and not very trustful of the federal government, will balk. But if the question is, can we and should we fix our political system to reduce the sway of money, to provide greater responsiveness to the middle class, greater transparency, then I think people will likely be more responsive. We have to reduce some of the major barriers in our system to updating a policy. I think an obvious example of that is that to the extent possible, we should be moving away from requiring a fight over every renewal, for example, the debt ceiling, which was once considered a kind of routine procedure, and now is and again will be used to try to block to gain as much leverage as possible by holding the federal government's credit rating hostage. But it also means increasing the transparency of what government does. And Suzanne has written about the importance of trying to bring some of the key benefits that Americans receive from government out into the open. I mean, it's a great paradox to me, at least, that the Tea Party movement, which was, by the way, a populist movement in its inception against the bailouts, is motivated, has its strongest a base among older white Americans who receive or will are set to receive and eager to receive Medicare and Social Security. As Theda Scotchpole has rightly pointed out, there's a sense of earned benefit. There's a feeling that this is a legitimate role for government. But there's also, I think, in that movement, a critique of the rest of government, right? The sense that it's no longer under the control of the citizenry. So the Tea Party may not be the force that would be pressing for the kinds of reforms that I would like, but it does point us towards some of the strategies and pressures that would be needed. Because ultimately, it seems to me that you're not going to have the kind of sustained change that's necessary without the empowerment of groups that represent the broad public. You cannot have a political reform without political reformers in government linked to citizen groups outside of it. And it's worth noting that the Tea Party has been much more and was much more effective than, say, Occupy Wall Street in grassroots organizing that's linked to national reform leaders, in providing a forward-looking vision that's directed against a contemporary perceived or actual threat, and the use of flexible participatory modes to try to bring people into these challenges. I don't think that the message that should guide such efforts has to be very complex. The middle class, drowning in debt, battered by economic insecurity, treading water or sinking while the rich ferry off in yachts, has been abandoned by our politics. Our democracy rests on flood walls between economic power and political power. Those flood walls are badly broken, and they must be rebuilt. Thank you. I'd be happy to, yeah. So I'm happy to call on people and take questions. Yes, here on the right. That's a good question, and the Pew report that I started out with was about this group. In fact, let me just show you one thing that it's cut off here. So they actually have the median household income for a family of four. It's a bit higher than 40,000. It's closer to $60,000.
$5,000 figure, which I assume is income without benefits.
Yeah, I don't know, but suffice it to say, it's if you look at the numbers, the share of people who are earning an income that say is between 75% and 200% of the median, which is the Pew's definition, and you know some people use 2 to 4 times the poverty line or 2 to 6 times the poverty line, has declined substantially, and so. One feature of inequality that I didn't talk about here is that it isn't just been the pulling away of the top, but also that, yes, there are people moving into that top 20%, but there's also lots of people who are moving down, right, into the, say, the bottom third. And so this sort of concentration of income at the top is almost mathematically, right, linked to the decline in the share of income going to the broad middle. Compared with other rich countries, we have a smaller middle class in that sense. But there's another sense in which people think about the middle class. This is the sense in which I was talking about at the outset, that middle class is more than just an income definition, right? It's a self-definition. It's an understanding of what it means to be an American, what the American dream is. And it's worth noting that those values were widely shared. If you poll people, not everyone says they're middle class. That's actually one of these sort of common misperceptions about Americans' views, that if you poll people and you give them the choice of being working class, a significant chunk of Americans will say they're working class. Even in the Pew survey where they use lower class, you got about 20% of Americans saying they were lower class. So lots of people, but very few people like to believe they're above the middle class. The highest people will go is upper middle class, and you will get usually like a vanishingly small and sometimes rather diluted, because they're diluted, not diluted, because their incomes are actually lower often than the upper middle class portion of people who are saying they're affluent. I love the fact that when you see these reports on the rich, services that are being provided, there's a whole industry that the political science Jeffrey Winter calls it the income defense industry, that's about trying to protect the incomes of the very rich. And they call these folks high net worth individuals, right? So that not rich. So Americans self-identify with these values, even if they don't self-identify with the middle class. They also are remarkably perceptive about where sort of the line of the middle class is, and they believe the middle class is being completely screwed, to use the technical term. What is really interesting, and what I want to emphasize, is that when you start to dig into what people think of as middle class, some of the key changes that I've been talking about sense of political efficacy, the feeling that you have the basic economic capacity to not just protect yourself against economic risk, but also to invest in the future of your children, your sense of optimism about the future, if not your personal optimism, the optimism about your children, those things have for the first time really taken a beating in this downturn. And Americans still are quite optimistic about the long term, but they have much less faith that the system works, much less faith that their children will have a better life than they did. And to me, that's the biggest risk, is that we'll lose that. Because that seems to me to be, more than anything else, what the American dream implies. It says it's not whether you're rich or you're poor, but whether or not if you know, as Bill Clinton put it and Barack Obama repeated, you work hard and you play by the rules, you'll be able to get ahead. The last generation has suggested that that's may not be true. The last few years has sent a signal, a really sort of blaring signal, that's in doubt. And I'll just say that in the work that I've been doing on long-term reform, that's the central question. It's how do we get the economy moving again in the short term? But more important, how do we rebuild this sense of confidence, this sense of optimism among the middle class as a whole? And in a realistic way, recognizing that we're not going to recreate the economy of the mid-20th century. The sheltered, union-dominated economy of that period is not coming back, but there's a lot of reasons to think that we could build an economy of broadly based prosperity in the 21st century if we invest in the human capital of citizens through pre-K and college education, if we make sure that we create the preconditions of productivity and prosperity, like good infrastructure and investments in research and development, and if we provide some of the basic economic security that employers once provided and no longer do. So there is no reason to think that people being afraid they're going to lose their health insurance when they lose their job, or having to scrape by and fear their retirement, is good for the long-term health of a nation. Quite the opposite. If you provide people some kind of basic level of economic security, they feel much more confident about an economy that produces risks as well as rewards. Yes, right here in the front.
There's no way to add an income. It's not counted as taxable income because it's too hard to collect. If you put that in, the numbers would all just get worse, dramatically worse. Secondly, I think we need to make a distinction between making money and earning money. Let me describe Mr. Madoff. he made a lot of money during a certain period. There's no way, if you think about it, we would call it earning his money. And I'll tell you that if you talk about the upper side and about 0.01 and above that, the finance, corporate, and you never mentioned the word hedge fund, but they're the big guys. Hedge fund guys, and there's been years when more than 24 hedge fund managers made over $1 billion each. So if you want to feel good and make a 30 or 40 million, you can think about the hedge fund guy.
Fractal inequality.
All right. Now, in all those areas, in finance, corporate leaders, and so on, what they do is no more to be called earning than what Mr. Madoff did. The difference is what Madoff did was illegal, but what they are doing is not illegal. But it's no more sense fair earning. If you look at the details of how they're paid, it's simply they're robbing the bank.
Okay. I definitely get your point, and I want to say a couple things. So first, that's a very important point about unrealized capital gains, and it comes out in the debate over the estate tax. I mean, one of the arguments for having an estate tax is that a lot of capital gains never get taxed, right? They're unrealized, they're being held, and the estate tax is one of the few ways in which indirectly we're taxing unrealized capital gains when they're passed on to heirs. And I do think the estate tax debate is really quite revealing for two reasons. One is that we've seen essentially the elimination of the idea that goes back to Teddy Roosevelt that we should prevent the accumulation of large estates and passing across generations. It's also the case, if you look at the estate tax debate, although it was framed in terms of small businesses and farmers, it's really a tiny slice of very, very rich families that would benefit from this. We should think probably, and this gets to your second point, we should think differently, I think, about that kind of wealth. It's not to answer the question, but there's a different, I think, moral calculus, if you will, with inheritance than there is with earnings. And so I think you raised the right question, and the question that we political scientists often want to dance past, which is this question of desert, right? And so I would say, I wouldn't want to cast judgment on all financial activities, but I want to say that I think an enormous part of the way our financial economy has evolved does involve massive systemic risks for the rest of the economy. And so a sort of basic fundamental principle, it doesn't get you all the way, is an economic principle, which is when you expose external costs on others, you should have to have those priced into the transactions. The short-term trading, which makes up an enormous part of what Wall Street does now, with a huge amounts of leverage, rests, I think, almost entirely, its logic rests on the idea that there's an asymmetry between losses and gains, right? The asymmetry between losses and gains comes from the fact that major losses will ultimately will elicit a government response. That's the bailout problem. And the bailout problem is worse now than it was before the financial crisis. I hate to be, again, the bearer of bad news, but the measures of financial concentration are just stunning, right? We're talking about the top financial institutions having much, much larger share of total financial assets than was true before the crisis. So my own view is there should be some kind of financial transaction tax. It's basically a very small tax on all financial transactions. London has something like this. Europe is considering it. That would basically internalize at least some of that systemic risk. But I think there's a larger issue here, which is that the new rich are different than the Gilded Age rich, the Great Gatsby rich, right? That generation of wealthy people, for a big chunk of them were old money and inherited money, and rentiers, as we sometimes call them, people who were living off of accumulated gains. And we may see that in the near future, the Hiltons and the Waltons. But right now, the people at the top are what we might call the working rich. These are people who work extremely hard. They're very stressed out. They work long hours. The traders pride themselves on not going to the bathroom while they're on the floor, right? Because and that kind of mentality, right? It's a kind of kill kind of world. That mentality is tied up with the idea that these folks are earning their income through hard work, right? And What I just think is very important to remember is that the difference between, say, the 1970s and today, in their capacity to earn those kind of massive rewards, are not tied up with how hard people are working. They're tied up with changes in our society, some of them beneficial, like the increased size of our economy, the greater knowledge intensiveness, the greater role of technology, some of them quite negative, right? Like the deregulation of finance, right? And so you've got to step back and you've got to ask, okay, what are the societal values at stake in the kind of transformation I'm talking about? To me, the most important issue here, because we may not worry that much about the 1% falling away from the top 10%. The greatest threat is to our democracy. And that's an area where I do think we can get some broad agreement if we step back in a sort of Rawlsian sense and ask ourselves, do we want a set of political institutions, if we were setting them up from scratch, where influence is so money weighted, where, as Bartels will show you a couple weeks from now, the poor essentially have, there's no correlation between the opinions of poor constituents and their senators, or where Marty Gillins in his new book, Affluence and Influence, suggests that even the middle class, when their preferences diverge from those of the top, seem not to have any influence on public policy. And if our answer is no, then we have to ask, A, do we want to change our economy or do we want to change our polity? I'd start with the politics because I think a lot of other things flow from that. If we can have a political system that is more capable of representing the interests, the demands of the broad middle class, then I hope, I expect that we'd also have one that would be producing policies that would be more likely to create an economy of broadly shared prosperity. Yeah, over here.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what accounts for your faith in the system of American government as it exists. And the related question is if our hope is these sort of grassroots citizens movements, and you mentioned the efficacy of the Tea Party over, say, the 99%.
Yeah, that's fair.
So where does the faith in the system going forward really come from?
Well, you know you're shaking it here. But so let me say first on this Republicans versus Democrats. I mean, I hope that I've conveyed a simple message, which is that both parties have been part of this transformation, but they haven't played the same role. So I do think there are differences between the parties. This is probably where Bartels and I differ the most. So it'll be interesting to see what he says a couple weeks from now, because his work showed very stark differences in distributional outcomes between Republicans and Democrats. Basically, he said Republican presidents are responsible for all the rise in inequality since World War II. But his measure of inequality was basically a measure of the ratio of the 80th to the 20th percentile. So it was a kind of broad measure of inequality. When you look at that figure, I was telling you, if you break it out by year, right, you see slightly perhaps greater growth under Republican presidents, although the 1990s is really the period of Clinton where you see really sharp growth. But there's really no major difference between Republicans and Democrats on that score. So I turn for hope, I turn in three places besides microbrewed beer. One is the history. Right, and I mentioned briefly the populists and the progressives. I would also note the civil rights movement, which is, although it faltered as a movement for economic justice, was an enormous success at transforming our society in ways that nobody thought was possible before it happened. And that links to the second part of the question, which is those movements, populism, progressivism, the New Deal, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the various rights revolutions that have spun off of that, they all rested on very intense grassroots mobilization, on people power, to use the cliche. And yet it seems as if that kind of sustained broad engagement is harder to get and quicker to go when it arrives. And that may well be particularly true on the left. I would push back a little bit about this portrayal of the Tea Party, only in the sense that, yes, the Tea Party movement did have, I think the Fox side of it is distinctive and not replicable, let's put it that way, social sciences. The role of money in the Tea Party is a bit more ambiguous. I mean, you know, if you read Scotchpole's book, and I encourage you to do it on the Tea Party, you know, here she is coming from the left side of the political spectrum and is just amazed by the degree of intense activity. And that intense activity, I think, bears some resemblance to the mobilization that occurred against President Bush, especially after his Social Security privatization proposal. So I guess one prescription, right, is if you want to have a grassroots movement that's pushing, I guess, toward the left, you want to have a target. But I'm not advocating here for any particular outcome in the next election. Barring that, it seems to me that you've got to have this longer-term focus, and it's got to be linked up with what's left of the infrastructure of organization that's concerned about middle-class standing. That's consumer and public interest groups. That is various groups like the ones I mentioned that Suzanne mentioned, that are supporting the prosperity agenda, prosperity for all agenda, like the National Council of La Raza, the National Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, and then ultimately it's labor. And to me, this is the biggest challenge, right? I mean, there is a huge debate taking place on very unfavorable terrain about organized labor. It's taking place around the one sector of labor that's grown and the one sector that people have the most ambivalence about, namely public sector unions. And Americans have seen, there's been a bit of a decline in public support for unions, but there's still a pretty strong sense that private sector unions are an important part of a well-functioning economy on the part of many Americans. But we may see over the next few years that capacity in the private sector almost entirely disappear. I mean, we're down below 10%. And I'm reminded when Tom Brokaw that was once asked what the goal of NBC Nightly News was, and he paused for a minute and he said, to survive. And in a sense, right, labor unions are at that stage, right, that survival stage. So it seems to me it's a pretty critical juncture. But if there's going to be any hope, it's going to come from taking some of the themes that were raised during the Occupy Wall Street protest, marrying them to some of the grassroots energy around the presidential reelection campaign, and moving beyond the close tie to a particular political figure or party to try to press for some broader reforms, whether that takes place in terms of political and money reforms at the national level, or whether it's focused, as is some of the organizing on the other side, at the state level. I mean, the challenge, it seems to me, is the same one that Franklin Roosevelt highlighted when a group of progressives came to his office and told him basically they wanted him to support a bill, and this may be an apocryphal story, and Marty Schefter will tell me if it is. At the end of the meeting, he said, "You've convinced me, now make me do it." Right? President Obama will act very differently if there's pressure on him to address these issues. Yes, over here.
You brought up labor unions and the unfortunate steady decline. I don't like that. But what's not really talked about as much in the perspective just that they had declined significantly worse than the private sector and the public sector is that the organized effort to break these unions is so powerfully funded and so effective. And the amount of political support now in Washington, D.C. for labor unions is still gone. It's very emblematic that a right-to-work state was opposed to the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah.
The hotel that everybody could stay in was a non-union hotel for the first time. And certainly in my lifetime, that's such a huge slap to organized labor to be given by the Democratic Party establishment. They could get away with it. Because they don't really feel they need them. This is now a disconnect where even the most powerful organized labor entities, Teamsters and so forth, can barely get a phone call return from the White House after several months. So the reality is I don't think that there is any representation of the working class and middle class at the left in Washington. And then we have to look for champions and, you know, of these technocrats who might, for whatever reason, have some sympathy for the system. There's no longer any real connection.
Wow, this is like just a downer, guys. Okay, so I want to end on a somewhat higher note because I want to first of all say I think that we're facing a kind of spiral of silence about labor, in the sense that many who will readily concede that labor unions were fundamental to the creation of the modern middle class, and not to mention the civil rights movement, have basically gone silent with regard to the challenges that labor unions are facing today. Part of that, as I said, is ambivalence about public sector unions, and which runs deep. I mean, our government is facing extremely significant fiscal strains, right? These are not created by some conspiracy, but reflect the fact that we have had tax cut after tax cut, right? And we have real pressures for increased spending. The result is that even Democratic legislators and legislatures are under very severe pressure to bring down spending. And we and our government basically spends, our local and state governments in particular, spend money in two main places, right? They spend money on education and the public sector workers who deliver it, and they spend money on healthcare, right? And that's where the pressure has been focused. And what I would say here is that it seems to me that this is a moment where there's a real need for some leadership in talking about the role that labor unions could play, the constructive role they could play in a more dynamic 21st century economy. You don't hear that, understandably, from labor leaders who are worried about protecting past gains. You certainly don't hear it from the business community. I think we have a climate of corporate lawlessness. The cost of violating labor laws is trivial for corporations. It's just part of the cost of doing business. And honestly, if you look back at the mid-20th century, there was a corporate elite that was much more favorable towards using government in positive ways and towards labor unions. But it wasn't because these guys, and they were all guys, of course, were somehow better or more responsible, as like Tom Friedman columns suggest. It was that they were heavily constrained, right? They were constrained by the fact there were actually labor unions in the workplace. They were constrained by the fact that government had come to play a much more important role, and they were shaped by a distinctive climate, World War II, the New Deal. Right now we have essentially a self-styled meritocratic elite at the top that has nonetheless never faced a kind of constraint. There's a culture of deference and entitlement. There's an expectation that whatever the elite wants to do is somehow in the interest of the nation as a whole because there aren't these pressures. So who is going to articulate the view that our future rests not just on freedom, but on constraint and on restraint? It rests on actually having countervailing powers in the private sector. It means that corporations have to fight with investor collectives to decide what executive pay is, or they have to work with labor unions or with their workers, or partner with government. A world in which collaboration and constraint exists is a world that is much more likely to produce the kind of broad-based economic gains, but we don't have a vocabulary for talking about it. And I would say that the place where that's most likely to happen in terms of labor is in the service sector. The new jobs that are being created are overwhelmingly service sector jobs. There's a burgeoning of human services, social services, and then, of course, the huge amounts of non-tradable goods in the service sector, where global competition is not the issue. The issue is worker power. The issue is whether or not we're going to recognize that these jobs should be professionalized, whether we do it through government contracting and say people who are working in nursing homes and getting paid by Medicare and Medicaid should be paid a decent wage and have opportunities for training and advancement, whether we're going to do it through national level laws that say, okay, if service sector jobs don't pay well or don't provide benefits, the government is going to make sure that those benefits are provided, or through, say, their earned income tax credit, that wages are raised. Whether we do it through a much more directive effort to try to stop employers from flagrantly violating the law, and that's going to require, unfortunately, it's going to require some pretty serious change in the way Washington works, of the sort that I've talked about. But whatever the path is, I do think we have to find a vocabulary, we have to find a set of policies that basically says, look, we're in a new economic world, but it doesn't have to be a dog-eat-dog economic world. We know that the mid-20th century economy was successful because it was built on the idea that we, as President Clinton put it, are in this together. That the only way in which we're going to prosper in a more competitive global economy is with those kind of shared investments and shared commitments. And the only way we're going to create that is if we reclaim our democracy. So thank you very much.